Rose, and then he never will. You'll have given up any hope of winning him from her. That made me wonder if I could have put up any opposition to Rose in the early days, when it would have been quite fair. I thought of the chance I missed on May Day when Simon and I walked to the village together. If only I could have been more fascinating. But I decided my fascination would have been embarrassing. I know Simon didn't care much for roses until he had fallen in love with her beauty. After that, of course, he found the fascination fascinating. Then I remembered Miss Marcy once saying, "Dear Rose will lead men a dance." And it struck me that Father meant much the same thing when he spoke of Rose showing her power over Simon. Suddenly I had a great desire to batter her. And as I was going to imagine away any chance of getting Simon, I decided to have a run for my money and batter Rose into the bargain. So I stoked up the kitchen fire and put the stew on for lunch, then drew the armchair close and gave my imagination its head. I was longing to anyhow, apart from its being a noble gesture. I visualized everything happening at Mrs. Cotton's flat. I gave it a balcony overlooking Hyde Park. We began there, then moved indoors. Rose came in while Simon was kissing me and was absolutely livid. Or was that in a later imagining? There have been so many that they have gradually merged into each other. I don't think I could bring myself to describe any of them in detail because, though they are wonderful at the time, they give me a flat, sick, ashamed feeling to look back on. And they are like a drug. One needs them oftener and oftener, and has to make them more and more exciting until at last one's imagination won't work at all. It comes back after a few days, though. Goodness knows how I can ever look Rose in the face after the things I have imagined saying and doing to her. I got as far as kicking her once. Of course, I always pretend that she isn't in love with Simon, merely after his money. Poor Rose. It's extraordinary how fond I can feel of her, really, not to mention guilty towards her, and yet hate her like poison in my imaginings. Coming back to Earth after that first one was particularly awful, because it was the one which gave Simon up irrevocably. The others didn't have the same tampering with fate feeling. But it is always dreadful when the pictures in front of one's eyes become meaningless, and the real world is there instead and seems meaningless too. I certainly wasn't in any mood for writing to Rose, but in the afternoon I forced myself to. It was like making up a letter for a character in a book to write. I told her how pleased I was with the bottle of scent, and put in bits about hell and Ab and the miserable weather. The rain was useful as a lead into. How lucky it was fine on Midsummer Eve. It was so nice that Simon was here for it. Tell him I enjoyed every minute. It was glorious writing that, almost like telling him I was glad he had kissed me. But after I posted the letter, I was worried in case he guessed what I meant. And as I walked back from the post office, I had the most agonizing thought. Supposing he had told Rose about kissing me and they had laughed about it. It hurt me so much that I moaned out loud. I wanted to fling myself down in the mud and beat my way into the ground. I had just enough sense to know what I should look like after trying, so I stayed upright. But I couldn't go on walking. I went and sat on a stile and tried to turn the thought out of my head. And then worse thoughts rushed in on me. I asked myself if it wasn't wrong of Simon to kiss me when he is in love with Rose, if he was the sort of man who thinks any girl will do to kiss. Of all the agonies, the worst is when I think badly of Simon. Not that I ever do for very long. After I had been sitting there in the rain for a while, I saw there was nothing dreadful in his having kissed me. In spite of his saying it wasn't due to his missing Rose, it probably was. Anyway, I think Americans kiss rather easily and frequently. Miss Marcy had some American magazines once, and there were pictures of people kissing on almost every page, including the advertisements. I expect Americans are affectionate as a nation. I should certainly never have been surprised if Neil had kissed me, and I shouldn't have thought it meant he was seriously in love. Somehow it seemed unlike Simon, but... Then I wondered if he had thought I expected it. If I had somehow invited a kiss. That made me want to die of shame, and yet was comforting because it put Simon in the right, if he had done it out of kindness. Suddenly I said aloud into the rain, "He won't tell Rose and laugh." And he didn't do anything wrong. Whatever his reasons were, they weren't wrong. If you love people, you take them on trust. Then I got off the stile and walked home, and in spite of the drenching rain, I felt quite warm. That little glow of comfort lasted me right through the evening, but was gone when I woke up next morning. Wakings are the worst times. Almost before my eyes are open, a great weight seems to roll onto my heart. I can usually roll it off a bit during the day. For one thing, food helps quite a lot, unromantic as that sounds. I have grown more and more ravenous, as I've grown more and more miserable. Sleep is wonderful too. I never thought of it as a pleasure before, but now I long for it. The best time of all is before I fall asleep at night, when I can hold the thought of Simon close to me and feel the misery slip away. I often sleep in the daytime too. Surely it isn't normal for anyone so miserably in love to eat and sleep so well. Am I a freak? I only know that I am miserable, I am in love, but I raven food and sleep. Another great luxury is letting myself cry. I always feel marvellously peaceful after that. But it is difficult to arrange times for it, as my face takes so long to recover. It isn't safe in the mornings, if I am to look normal when I meet Father at lunch. And the afternoons are no better, as Thomas is home by 5. It would be all right in bed at night, but such a waste, as that is my happiest time. Days when Father goes over to read in the Scotney Library are good crying days. On the Wednesday of that first week of mud and misery, I went to see the vicar. He has a lot of old music, and I hoped I might find Sheep May Safely Graze. The rain stopped for a few hours that morning, but it was very cold and damp, and the battered countryside looked rather as I felt. As I sloshed along the God's End Road, planning to be careful not to give myself away to the vicar, I found myself wondering if it would be a relief to confess to someone, as Lucy Snow did in Villette. The vicar isn't high church enough for confessions, and certainly most of me would have loathed to tell him or anybody else one word. But I did have a feeling that a person as wretched as I ought to be able to get some sort of help from the church. Then I told myself that as I never gave the church a thought when I was feeling happy, I could hardly expect it to do anything for me when I wasn't. You can't get insurance money without paying in premiums. I found the vicar starting to plan a sermon, wrapped in the collie dog carriage rug. I do love his study. It has old green panelling, except for the wall that is bookshelves from floor to ceiling. His housekeeper keeps everything very shining and clean. "Now this is splendid," he said. "An excuse to stop working and to light a fire." He lit it. Even to watch it crackling up was cheering. He said he didn't think he had Sheep May Safely Graze, but I could look through his music. Most of it is in old calf-bound volumes he bought at the country house sale. They have a musty smell, and the printing looks different from modern music. There is an elaborately engraved page in front of each piece. As one turns the pages, one thinks of all the people who have turned them in the past, and it seems to take one back closer to the composers. I like to think of the Beethoven pieces being played not very many years after he died. I soon came across Air from Handel's Water Music, which was no longer specially valuable to me, but I never found Sheep May Safely Graze. Still, looking through the old volumes was soothing, because thinking of the past made the present seem a little less real. And while I was searching, the vicar got out biscuits and Madeira. I never had Madeira before, and it was lovely. The idea almost more than the taste, because it made me feel I was paying a morning call in an old novel. For a moment, I drew away from myself and thought, poor Cassandra. No, it never comes right for her. She goes into a decline. We talked of the Cottons and Scotney, and how wonderful everything was for everybody, and how happy we were for Rose. He was most interested to hear Simon had spent Midsummer Eve with me, and asked lots of questions about it. After that, we got started on religion, which surprised me rather, as the vicar so seldom mentions it. I mean, to our family. Naturally, it must come up in his daily life.
"You ought to try it one of these days," he said. "I believe you'd like it."
I said, "But I have tried it, haven't I? I've been to church. It never seems to take." He laughed and said he knew I'd exposed myself to infection occasionally.
"But catching things depends so much on one's state of health.
You should look in on the church if you're ever mentally run down." I remembered my thoughts on the way to the village. "Oh, it wouldn't be fair to rush to the church because one was miserable," I said, taking care to look particularly cheerful.
"It'd be most unfair not to. You'd be doing religion out of its very best chance."
"You mean, man's extremity is God's opportunity?"
"Exactly. Of course, there are extremities at either end. Extreme happiness invites religion almost as much as extreme misery."
I told him I'd never thought of that. He helped me to some more Madeira, then said,
"In addition, I think religion has a chance of a look-in whenever the mind craves solace in music or poetry, in any form of art at all.
Personally, I think it is an art, the greatest one, an extension of the communion all the other arts attempt."
"I suppose you mean communion with God."
He gave such a snort of laughter that his Madeira went the wrong way.
"What on earth did I say that was funny?" I asked, while he was mopping his eyes. "It was the utter blankness of your tone. God might have been a long, wet week, which he's certainly treating us to."
He glanced at the window. The rain had started again so heavily that the garden beyond the streaming panes was just a blur of green.
"How the intelligent young do fight shy of the mention of God. It makes them feel both bored and superior."
I tried to explain, "Well, once you stop believing in an old gentleman with a beard, it's only the word God, you know. It makes such a conventional noise."
"It's merely shorthand for where we come from, where we're going and what it's all about."
"And do religious people find out what it's all about? Do they really get the answer to the riddle?"
"They get just a whiff of an answer sometimes."
He smiled at me, and I smiled back, and we both drank our Madeira. Then he went on.
"I suppose church services make a conventional noise to you too, and I rather understand it. Oh, they're all right for the old hands and they make for sociability, but I sometimes think their main use is to help weather churches, like smoking pipes to colour them, you know. If any, well, unreligious person needed consolation from religion, I'd advise him or her to sit in an empty church. Sit, not kneel. And listen, not pray.
Prayer's a very tricky business."
"Goodness, is it?"
"Well, for inexperienced prayers, it sometimes is. You see, they're apt to think of God as a slot machine.
If nothing comes out, they say, 'I knew dashed well it was empty,' when the whole secret of prayer is knowing the machine's full."
"But how can one know?"
"By filling it oneself."
"With faith?"
"With faith. I expect you find that another boring word, and I warn you, this slot machine metaphor is going to break down any moment. But if ever you're feeling very unhappy, which you obviously aren't at present, after all the good fortune that's come to your family recently, well, try sitting in an empty church.
And listening for a whiff."
We both laughed, and then he said that it was just as reasonable to talk of smelling or tasting God as of seeing or hearing him. "If ever one has any luck, one would probably know with all one's senses, and none of them.
Probably as good a way of any of describing it is that we shall come over all queer."
"But haven't you already?"
He sighed and said the whiffs were few and far between. "But the memory of them everlasting," he added softly. Then we fell silent, both of us staring at the fire. Rain kept falling down the chimney, making little hissing noises. I thought what a good man he is, yet never annoyingly holy. And it struck me for the first time that if such a clever, highly educated man can believe in religion, It is almost impudent of an ignorant person like me to feel bored and superior about it. For I realized that it wasn't only the word God that made me feel like that. I wondered if I was an atheist. I have never thought of myself as one. And sometimes, on very lovely days, I have felt almost sure there is something somewhere. And I pray every night, though I think my prayers are only like wishing on the new moon. Not quite, though. I pray just in case there is a God. I haven't prayed about my misery over Simon because I mustn't ask that he shall love me, and I won't ask that I shall stop loving him. I'd rather die. Certainly, I never felt any sense of communion with God while praying. The only flicker of that I ever had was during those few minutes I wandered round King's Crypt Cathedral at sunset, and it went off when I heard our headmistress's voice straying on about the Saxon remains. Sitting there with the vicar, I tried to recapture my feelings in the cathedral, but they merged into the memory of the cathedral-like avenue I saw when I was describing Midsummer Eve. And then the cathedral, the avenue, my love for Simon, and myself writing about all these in the attic were in my mind together, each enclosed in its own light, and yet each one part of the other. And all the time I was staring into the vicar's fire. I didn't come to earth until the church clock struck the half hour. Then I jumped up to go, and got invited to stay and lunch. But I felt I ought to get back to cook Father his meal. While the vicar was helping me on with my raincoat, he asked me to look in at the church in case he had left the vestry window open and the rain was driving in. Actually, we found the rain had stopped, but he still wanted the window shut. He said it was sure to start pouring again, probably just as he was beginning his after-luncheon nap. He stood watching me as I ran across the churchyard. I gave him one last wave before I went into the church by the little side door. As I closed it behind me, it struck me as almost funny that he had sent me into a church. Even advised me how to get consolation from religion without having the faintest idea I was in need of it. The window wasn't open after all. As I came from the vestry, I thought, well, here you are in an empty church. You'd better give it a chance. I was close to the altar, so I had a good look at it. The brasses and the altar cloth seemed quite extraordinarily meaningless to me. The white roses were fresh, but rain-battered. They had the utterly still look that altar flowers always have. Everything about the altar seemed unnaturally still, austere, withdrawn. I thought, I don't feel helped or comforted at all. Then I remembered the vicar's nice fat voice saying, sit, listen. He had told me not to pray, and as looking at an altar always seems to turn my thoughts to prayers, I sat on the steps and looked towards the main body of the church. I listened hard. I could hear rain still pouring from the gutters and a thin branch scraping against one of the windows. But the church seemed completely cut off from the restless day outside, just as I felt cut off from the church. I thought, I am a restlessness, inside a stillness, inside a restlessness. After a minute or so, the enclosed silence began to press on my ears. I thought at first that this was a good sign, but nothing interesting happened. Then I remembered what the vicar had said about knowing God with all one's senses. So I gave my ears a rest and tried my nose. There was a smell of old wood, old carpet hassocks, old hymn books, a composite musty, dusty smell. No scent from the cold altar roses, and yet there was a faint, stuffy sweetness around the altar. I found it came from the heavily embroidered cloth. I tried my sense of taste next, but naturally it only offered a lingering of Madeira and biscuits. Touch. Just the cold stone of the steps. As for sight, well, of course there was plenty to see. The carved, rude screen. The great de Goddess tomb. The high pulpit, which managed to look both particularly empty and slightly rebuking. Oh, I noticed dozens of things, many of them beautiful, but nothing beyond sight came in by the eyes. So I closed them. The vicar had said, all senses, and none of them. And I thought that perhaps if I made my mind a blank. I have often tried, I once had an idea it was the way to foresee the future. But I never got any further than imagining blackness. Sitting on the altar steps, I saw a blacker blackness than ever before, and I felt it as well as saw it. Tons of darkness seemed to be pressing on me. Suddenly I remembered a line in a poem by Vaughan. There is in God, some say, a deep but dazzling darkness. And the next second, the darkness exploded into light. Was that God? Did it really happen? I asked myself. But the honest part of my mind answered, no, you imagined it. Then the clock up above boomed the three quarters, filling the air with sound. I opened my eyes and was back in a beautiful, chilly, stuffy church that didn't seem to care whether I lived or died. The clock made me realise that I was going to be late with Father's lunch, so I ran most of the way home, only to find that he had helped himself to food. The cold meat looked as if he had carved it with a trowel and gone out. As his bicycle was missing, I guessed he had ridden over to Scotney. I took a chance on getting my face right in time for tea and had a very good cry with cake and milk afterwards, and felt so much better than I usually do, even after crying, that I wondered if I really had come by some little whiff of God while I was in the church. But the next morning, the weight on my heart was the worst I'd ever known. It didn't move at all while I got our breakfasts, and by the time Stephen and Thomas had gone and Father had shut himself in the gatehouse, it was so bad that I found myself going round leaning against walls. I can't think why misery makes me lean against walls, but it does. For once I didn't feel like crying. I wanted to shriek. So I ran out in the rain to an empty field a long way from anywhere and screamed blue murder. And then felt quite extraordinarily silly. And so very wet. I had a sudden desire to be sitting with the kind vicar by his fire, drinking Madeira again. And as I was almost halfway to God's End, as the crow flies, I went on, scrambling through hedges and ditches. I kept trying to think of a good excuse for this second visit. The best I could manage was that I had been caught out without my raincoat and was frightened of taking a chill. But I was really past minding what the vicar or anyone else thought of me, if only I could get to the warm fire and the Madeira. And then, when I arrived at the vicarage, there was no one in. I stood there ringing the bell and banging on the door, feeling I could somehow make someone be there, yet knowing all the time that I couldn't. Shall I crawl into the church and wait? I wondered, coming down the streaming garden path. But just then, Mrs. Jakes called across from the Keys that the vicar and his housekeeper were shopping in King's Crypt and wouldn't be home until the evening. I ran over and asked if she would trust me for the price of a glass of port. She laughed and said she couldn't legally sell me a drink before 12 o'clock, but she would give me one as a present. "And my goodness, you need it," she said, as I followed her into the bar. "You're wet through. Take that dress off and I'll dry it by the kitchen fire." There was a man mending the sink in the kitchen, so I couldn't sit in there without my dress, but she bolted the door of the bar and said she would see that no one came through from the kitchen. I handed my gym dress over and sat up at the bar in my vest and black school knickers, drinking my port. The port was nice and warming. But I don't think old country bars are very cheerful places. There is something peculiarly depressing about the smell of stale beer. If I had been in a good mood, I might have liked the thought of villagers drinking there for 300 years. But as it was, I kept thinking of how dreary their lives must have been, and that most of them were dead. There was a looking-glass at the back of the bar, facing the window, and reflected in it I could see the wet tombstones in the churchyard. I thought of the rain going down, down to the sodden coffins, and all the time my wet hair kept dripping down my back inside my vest. However, by the time I finished the port, I was less violently miserable. I just felt lumpish, and my eyes kept getting fixed on things. I found myself staring at the bottles of creme de menthe and cherry brandy that Rose and I had our drinks out of on May Day. And suddenly, I felt the most bitter hatred for Rose's green creme de menthe, and a deep affection for my ruby cherry brandy. I went to the kitchen door and put my head round. "Please, Mrs. Jakes," I called. "Can I have a cherry brandy? It's striking 12 now, so I can owe you for it without breaking the law." She came and got it for me. And after she put the bottle back, I could gloat over there being more gone out of it than out of the creme de menthe bottle. "Now everyone will think the cherry brandy's the popular one," I thought. Then two old men came knocking at the door, wanting their beer, and Mrs. Jakes whisked me and my drink out of the bar. "You can wait in Miss Marcy's room," she said. "Your dress won't be dry for quite a while yet." Miss Marcy has an upstairs room at the inn, well away from the noise of the bar. Ever since she came to Godson, she has talked of having her own cottage, but year after year she stays on at the Keys. And I don't think she will ever move now. Mrs. Jakes makes her very comfortable, and the inn is so handy for the school. As I climbed the stairs, I was surprised to find how wobbly my legs were. I said to myself, "Poor child, I'm more exhausted than I realized." It was a relief to sit down in Miss Marcy's wicker armchair, except that it was much lower than I expected. I spilt a valuable amount of cherry brandy. I finished the rest of it with deep satisfaction. Each time I took a sip, I thought, "That's one in the eye for the creme de menthe." And then the very confusing thought struck me that generally green is my colour and pink is roses. So the liqueurs were all mixed up and silly. And then I wondered if I was a little bit drunk. I had a look at myself in Miss Marcy's dressing table glass, and I looked awful. My hair was in rat's tails, my face was dirty, and my expression simply maudlin. For no reason at all, I grinned at myself. Then I began to think, who am I? Who am I? Whenever I do that, I feel one good push would shove me over the edge of lunacy. So I turned away from the glass and tried to get my mind off myself. I did it by taking an interest in Miss Marcy's room. It really is fascinating. All her personal possessions are so very small. The pictures are postcard reproductions of old masters. She has lots of metal animals about an inch long, little wooden shoes, painted boxes only big enough to hold stamps. And what makes things look even tinier than they are is that the room is large, with great oak beams, and all Mrs. Jake's furniture is so huge. While I was examining the miniature Devon pictures on the mantelpiece, five of them, with one wild flower in each, the glow from the cherry brandy wore off, probably because the wind down the chimney was blowing right through my knickers. So I wrapped myself in the quilt and lay on the bed. I was on the fringe of sleep when Miss Marcy arrived home for her lunch. "You poor, poor child," she cried, coming over to put her hand on my forehead. "I wonder if I ought to take your temperature." I told her there was nothing wrong with me but strong drink. She giggled and blinked and said, "Well, really?" And I suddenly felt very world-worn and elderly in comparison with her. Then she handed me my gym dress and got me some hot water. After I had washed, I felt quite normal, except that the whole morning lay on my conscience in a dreary, shaming sort of way. "I must dash home," I said. "I'm half an hour late with Father's lunch already." "Oh, your father's at Scotney again," said Miss Marcy. "They're giving him a nice thick steak." She had heard from Mrs. Jakes, who had heard from the butcher, who had heard from the Scotney cook. "So you can stay and have your lunch with me. Mrs. Jakes is going to send up enough for two." She has her meals on trays from the inn kitchen, but she keeps things she calls extra treats in the big mahogany corner cupboard. "I like to nibble these at night," she said as she was getting some biscuits out. "I always wake up around 2 o'clock and fancy something to eat." I had a flash of her lying in the wide, sagging bed, watching the moonlit square of the lattice window while she crunched her biscuits. "Do you lie awake long?" I asked. "Oh, I generally hear the church clock strike the quarter. Then I tell myself to be a good girl and go back to sleep. I usually make up some nice little story until I drop off." "What sort of story?" "Oh, not real stories, of course. Sometimes I try to imagine what happens to characters in books, after the books finish, I mean. Or I think about the interesting people I know. Dear Rose shopping in London, or Stephen being photographed by that kind Mrs. Fox Cotton. I love making up stories about people." "Don't you ever make them up about yourself?" She looked quite puzzled.
Do you know, I don't believe I ever do. I suppose I don't find myself very interesting.
There was a thump on the door, and she went to take the tray in. Mrs. Jakes had sent up stew and apple pie.
Oh, good, said Miss Marcy. Stew is so comforting on a rainy day.
As we settled down to eat, I said how extraordinary it must be not to find oneself interesting.
Didn't you ever, Miss Marcy?
She thought while she finished an enormous mouthful.
I think I did when I was a girl. My dear mother always said I was very self-centred, and so discontented.
I said, You aren't now. What changed you?
God sent me a real grief, dear.
Then she told me that her parents had died within a month of each other, when she was 17, and how dreadfully she had felt it.
Oh, dear, I couldn't believe the sun would ever shine again.
Then our local clergyman asked me to help with some children he was taking into the country.
And, do you know, it worked a miracle for me.
I suppose that was the beginning of finding others more interesting than myself. It wouldn't work a miracle for me, I said. I mean, if I were ever unhappy. She said she thought it would in the end, then asked me if I was missing Rose much. I noticed she was looking at me rather searchingly, so I said, Oh, yes, very casually, and talked brightly about Rose's trousseau and how happy I was for her, until we heard children's voices under the window as they trooped back to school. Then Miss Marcy jumped up and powdered her nose very white with a tiny powder puff out of a cardboard box.
It's singing this afternoon, she said. We always look forward to that.
I thought of the singing on May Day, and of Simon, so embarrassed and so kind, making his speech to the children. Oh, lovely day, before he had proposed to Rose. We went downstairs and I thanked Mrs. Jakes for everything, including the loan of the cherry brandy. A shilling, and that was a reduced price. Drink is ruinous. The rain had stopped, but it was still very grey and chilly.
I hope it cheers up by Saturday, said Miss Marcy, as we dodged the drips from the chestnut tree, because I'm giving the children a picnic. I suppose, dear, you couldn't find time to help me. You'd think of such splendid games.
I'm afraid I'm a bit busy at the castle, I said quickly. The children were screaming over some game in the playground, and I didn't feel I could stand an afternoon of that.
How thoughtless of me. Of course, you have your hands full at the weekends, with the boys home to be looked after as well as your father. Perhaps you have some free time in these long, light evenings. Some of the old folks do love to be read to, you know.
I stared at her in astonishment. Neither Rose nor I have ever gone in for that sort of thing. Incidentally, I don't believe the villagers really like good works being done to them. Miss Marcy must have noticed my expression, because she went on hurriedly.
Oh, it was just an idea. I thought it might take you out of yourself a bit, if you're finding life dull without Rose.
Not really, I said brightly. And heaven knows, one can't call misery dull exactly. Dear Miss Marcy, little did she know I had more than missing Rose on my mind. Just then, some children came up with a frog in a cardboard box. So she said goodbye and went off with them to the pond to watch it swim. When I got home, the castle was completely deserted. Even Ab and Hel were out. I felt guilty because they had had no dinner, and called them, but they didn't come. My voice sounded despairing, and I suddenly felt lonelier than I ever remember feeling, and more deeply sad. Everything I looked at was grey. Grey water in the moat, great grey towering walls, remote grey sky. Even the wheat, which was between green and gold, seemed colourless. I sat on the bedroom window seat staring woodenly at Miss Blossom. Suddenly her voice spoke in my head. You go to that picnic, dearie. I heard myself ask her why. Because little Miss Blinkeyes is right. It would take you out of yourself. And doing things for others gives you a lovely glow.
So does port, I said cynically.
That's no way to talk, not at your age, said Miss Blossom.
Though I must say you'd have made a cat laugh walking about in your drawers with that cherry brandy. Fancy you having a taste for drink.
Well, I can't drown my sorrows in it often, I told her. It's too expensive.
Good works are cheaper.
So is religion,
said Miss Blossom. "And some say that's best of all. You could get it all right if you went on trying, you know, you being so fond of poetry. Now, it's very odd, but I've often told myself things through Miss Blossom that I didn't know I knew. When she said that about my getting religion, I instantly realised that she was right. And it came as such a surprise to me that I thought, heavens, have I been converted? I soon decided that it wasn't quite so drastic as that. All that had come to me really was, well, the feasibility of conversion. I suddenly knew that religion, God, something beyond everyday life, was there to be found provided one is really willing. And I saw that though what I felt in the church was only imagination, it was a step on the way, because imagination itself can be a kind of willingness, a pretense that things are real due to one's longing for them. It struck me that this was somehow tied up with what the vicar said about religion being an extension of art. And then I had a glimpse of how religion really can cure you of sorrow. Somehow make use of it, turn it to beauty, just as art can make sad things beautiful. I found myself saying, sacrifice is the secret. You have to sacrifice things for art, and it's the same with religion. And then the sacrifice turns out to be a gain. Then I got confused and I couldn't hold on to what I meant, until Miss Blossom remarked, nonsense, ducky. It's perfectly simple. You lose yourself in something beyond yourself, and it's a lovely rest. I saw that, all right. Then I thought, but that's how Miss Marcy cured her sorrow, too, only she lost herself in other people instead of in religion. Which way of life was best, hers or the vicar's? I decided that he loves God and merely likes the villagers, whereas she loves the villagers and merely likes God. And then I suddenly wondered if I could combine both ways, love God and my neighbour equally. Was I really willing to? And I was. Oh, for a moment, I truly was. I saw myself going to church regularly, getting myself confirmed, making a little chapel with flowers and candles, and being so wonderful to everyone at home and in the village, telling stories to the children, reading to the old people. I dare say Tat could disguise that one was doing good works to them. Would I be sincere, or just pretending? Even if it began as a pretense, surely it would grow real before very long. Perhaps it was real already, for the very thought of it rolled the weight of misery off my heart, drove it so far away that though I saw it still, I no longer felt it. And then a most peculiar thing happened. I found myself seeing the new road that skirts King's Crypt, wide, straight, with plenty of room for through traffic. And then I saw the busy part of the town, with its tangle of narrow old streets that are so awful for motorists on market days, but so very, very beautiful. Of course, what my mind's eye was trying to tell me was that the vicar and Miss Marcy had managed to bypass the suffering that comes to most people, he by his religion, she by her kindness to others. And it came to me that if one does that, one is liable to miss too much along with the suffering. Perhaps, in a way, life itself. Is that why Miss Marcy seems so young for her age? Why the vicar, in spite of all his cleverness, has that look of an elderly baby? I said aloud, I don't want to miss anything. And then misery came rushing back like a river that has been dammed up. I tried to open my heart to it, to welcome it as part of my life's experience. And at first that made it easier to bear. Then it got worse than ever before. It was physical as well as mental. My heart and ribs and shoulders and chest, even my arms ached. I longed so desperately for someone to comfort me that I went and laid my head on Miss Blossom's bust. I thought of it as soft and motherly, under a royal blue satin blouse, and imagined her saying, "That's right. Go through it, not round it, ducky. It's the best way for most of us in the end." And then a different voice spoke in my head. A bitter, sarcastic voice. My own at its very nastiest. It said, "You've sunk pretty low, my girl, clasping a dressmaker's dummy. And aren't you a bit old for this Miss Blossom nonsense?" Then, for the first time in my life, I began to wonder how I did Miss Blossom.
Was she like Stephen's mother, but not so humble? Or nearer to a charwoman of Aunt Millicent's? Or had I taken her from some character in a book? Suddenly I saw her more vividly than ever before, standing behind the bar of an old-fashioned London pub. She looked at me most reproachfully, then put a sealskin jacket over her blue blouse, turned off all the lights, and went out into the night, closing the door behind her. The next second her bust was as hard as a board and smelt of dust and old glue, and I knew she was gone for ever. Luckily, Heloise came in then, or I should have cried myself into a state beyond recovery before tea time. You can't cry on Heloise. She thumps her tail sympathetically but looks embarrassed and moves away. Anyhow, I had to get her long overdue dinner. I haven't been able to bear looking at Miss Blossom since then. It isn't only that she is now nothing more than a dressmaker's dummy. She makes me think of the corpse of a dressmaker's dummy. Religion, good work, strong drink. Oh, but there is another way of escape. A wicked one, far worse than drink. I tried it on my birthday a week ago. When I woke up that morning, the sun was shining, the first time for over a fortnight. I had barely taken this in when I heard music just outside my bedroom door. I sprang up and dashed out to the landing, and there, on the floor, was a small portable wireless, with a card on it saying, "Many happy returns from Stephen." That was what he had been saving up for. That was why he had posed for Leader Fox Cotton. I yelled out, "Stephen! Stephen!" Thomas shouted from the hall, "He's gone off to work early. I think he felt embarrassed about being thanked. It's quite a good little wireless. Get dressed quickly and we'll play it over breakfast." He came bounding upstairs and had carried the wireless off before I had so much as turned the dials. I was just going to tell him to bring it back when I thought, heavens, what does it matter? The early morning wait had descended on my heart. While I dressed, I worked it out that only 2 weeks and 2 days before, owning a wireless would have made me deliriously happy. And now it didn't mean a thing. Then it struck me that I could at least do my suffering to music. When I got down, I found that Stephen had set the breakfast table for me and put flowers on it. "And there's my present," said Thomas. "I haven't wrapped it up because I'm just in the middle of it." It was a book on astronomy, which he is very much interested in. I was glad he had chosen something he wanted himself, because though he gets a little pocket money now, it will take a long time to make up for all the years he didn't have any. Father came down then. Of course, he hadn't remembered my birthday. "But Topaz will," he said cheerfully. "She'll send you something from me." He was horrified to see the wireless. He has always said that being without one is one of the few pleasures of poverty. But he got interested during breakfast. Only he couldn't bear the music or voices. What he liked were the atmospherics. "I suppose you wouldn't care to lend it to me for an hour or so," he said, after Thomas had gone off to school. "Those noises are splendid." I let him take it. All that really mattered to me was whether or not Simon would send me a present. The parcel post came at 11. There was a dressing gown from Topaz, a Shakespeare from Father, so tactful of Topaz to remember how he hates lending me his, a nightgown, real silk from Rose, 6 pairs of silk stockings from Mrs. Cotton, and a big box of chocolates from Neil. Nothing from Simon. Nothing from Simon, indeed. I was still sitting numbed with disappointment when a motor horn hooted in the lane. The next minute a van drew up, and a driver plonked a crate down on the drawbridge. I yelled up asking Father to come down, and between us we prized the lid off. Inside was a wireless and a gramophone combined. Oh, the most wonderful thing! When shut it was like a fat suitcase with a handle to carry it by. The outside is a lovely blue, like linen but shiny. There was a record case to match. Nobody ever had such a glorious present.
Simon had enclosed a note saying, "Dear Cassandra, I wanted to send you an electric one, but remembered you've no electricity. The radio works from batteries that can be recharged at the garage in Scotney, but the phonograph is only the old-fashioned type that has to be wound up. Still, it's better than nothing. I'm sending you the Debussy you liked, but I couldn't get the Bach record I played to you. Borrow anything you want from Scotney until you find out what your musical tastes really are, and then I'll buy you lots more records. They swear the thing will get to you on the right day, and I do hope it does. Many, many happy returns. I'll be seeing you soon. Love from Simon." It was in pencil, written at the shop, so I couldn't expect it to be long or personal. And it did say, "Love." He might have put just "yours" or "in haste" or something. Of course, I knew it didn't mean my kind of love, but it was valuable. I read the note again and again, while Father got the most agonizing noises out of the wireless. "Oh, stop!" I cried at last. "It can't be good for it to shriek like that." "Sounds like the lost souls of seagulls, doesn't it?" he shouted above the din. I pushed past him and turned it off. In the sudden quietness, we could just hear Stephen's wireless playing away by itself in the gatehouse room. Father said, "Has it occurred to you what this thing is going to do to your Swain?" All that I felt was resentment against Stephen because his being hurt was going to interfere with my pleasure in Simon's present. Not very much, though. Nothing could do that. Luckily, Father didn't wait for an answer. "This is a much stronger wireless," he went on. "I'll borrow it a while." I shouted, "No!" so loudly that he stared in astonishment. "I'm longing to try the gramophone," I added, trying to sound calm and reasonable. He suddenly smiled and said, "Well, well," in an almost fatherly voice, then actually carried the machine indoors for me and left me alone with it. I got the records out of their corrugated paper and played them and played them. There were some Bach preludes and fugues, as well as the Debussy album. Simon hadn't sent the Lover record. By the time Stephen got home, my better nature had asserted itself and I was terribly worried about his feelings. I had his wireless in the kitchen. Father had lost interest in it, and I was careful to have it on full blast when he came in. I nearly burst myself thanking him for it, and I don't think I have ever seen him look so pleased. I had asked Father during lunch if it would be a good idea to hide Simon's present for a day or two, but he thought that would be harder for Stephen in the end. "Just tell him how glad you are to have a really lightweight wireless you can carry around, and that you'll probably only use Simon's for the gramophone," he suggested. And I thought it was very sensible of him. But the next minute I saw him turning a record round and round as if he were reading the grooves. And surely a man who tries to read a gramophone record cannot be normal. I did my best to break the news to Stephen tactfully. I said all Father had advised, and a lot more besides. "Yours has a real wooden case," I told him, "with such a beautiful high polish." But the light went out of his eyes. He asked if he could see Simon's present. I had carried it up to my bedroom. After staring at it a few seconds, he said, "Yes, that's very handsome," and turned to go. "The wireless part isn't very good," I called after him, untruthfully. He went downstairs. Oh, I was so sorry for him, after all the months he had been saving up. I ran after him, and from the top of the kitchen stairs I could see him staring at his little brown wireless. He turned it off, then went out into the garden with a most bitter expression on his face. I caught up with him as he was crossing the drawbridge. "Let's go for a little walk," I said. "All right, if you want to," he said it without looking at me. We trudged down the lane. I felt as I did once when Rose had very bad toothache, that it was callous of me to be so separate from the pain, that just being sorry for suffering people isn't enough. Yet when I asked myself if on Stephen's account I would be willing not to have had Simon's present, I knew that I wouldn't. I tried to talk naturally about the two machines. enlarging on how I could carry his little one from room to room, and even take it out of doors. Although I knew that unless Stephen was around I should lug Simon's everywhere, even if it broke my back. I suppose I overdid it because he interrupted and said, "It's all right, you know." I looked at him quickly. He tried to smile reassuringly, but didn't quite let his eyes meet mine. "Oh, Stephen," I cried, "it was a much bigger present from you. Simon didn't have to save or work for it." "No, that was my privilege," he said quietly. That seemed to me a most beautiful way for him to have put it. It made me sorrier for him than ever. So sorry that I found myself almost wishing I had fallen in love with him instead of with Simon. Just then he added, very softly, "My dear." And that second, a wild idea flashed into my mind. Oh, why did it? Was it something in his voice awoke that feeling in me? Or was it because we were passing the larch wood and I remembered how I once imagined going into it with him? I stopped walking and stared at him. His face was golden from the sunset. He asked me if I wanted to turn back. I said, "No, let's see if there are any late bluebells in the wood." He looked at me quickly, right into the eyes at last. "Come on," I said. As we pushed aside the first green trails of larch, I thought, well, this will disprove my theory that things I've imagined happening never really do happen. But it didn't, because everything was so different from my imagining. The wood had been thinned out, so it wasn't cool and dark as I expected. The air was still warm, and the rays of the sinking sun shone in from behind us. The tree trunks glowed redly. There was a hot, resinous smell instead of the scent of bluebells. The only ones left were shriveled and going to seed. And instead of a still, waiting feeling, there was a choking excitement. Stephen didn't say any of the things I once invented for him. Neither of us spoke a word. I led the way all the time and reached the little grassy clearing in the middle of the wood before he did. There I turned and waited for him. He came closer and closer to me, then stood still, staring at me questioningly. I nodded my head, and then he took me in his arms and kissed me, very gently. It didn't mean a thing to me. I know I didn't kiss him in return. But suddenly he changed and kissed me more and more, not gently at all. And I changed too, and wanted him to go on and on. I didn't even stop him when he pulled my dress down over my shoulder. It was he who stopped in the end. "Don't let me, don't let me," he gasped, and pushed me away so violently that I nearly fell over. As I staggered backwards, I had a wild feeling of terror, and the minute I regained my balance, I plunged blindly back through the wood. He called after me. "Mind your eyes! It's all right. I'm not coming after you." But I went on, thrusting my way through the larches, shielding my face with my arm. I ran all the way to the castle and dashed up the kitchen stairs, meaning to lock myself in my room. But I slipped when I was halfway up, banging my knee badly, and then I burst into tears and just lay there sobbing. The awful thing is that something in me hoped that if I stayed there long enough, he would come in and see how wretched I was. Though I still can't make out why I wanted him to. After a little while, I heard him at the kitchen door. "Cassandra, please stop crying," he called. "I wasn't coming in, but when I heard you, please, please stop." I still went on. He came to the foot of the stairs. I began to pull myself up by the banisters, still crying. He said, "But it's all right. Really it is. There's nothing wrong in it if we love each other." I turned on him fiercely. "I don't love you. I hate you."
And then I saw the look in his eyes and realised how dreadful it all was for him. Until then, I had only been thinking of my own misery. I gasped out, "No, no, I don't mean that, but... oh, I'll never be able to explain." And then I dashed through to my room and locked both doors. I was just going to fling myself on the bed when I caught sight of Simon's present on the window seat. I went over, closed the gramophone part and lay with my head and arms on it. And for the first time in my life, I wished I were dead. When it was quite dark, I pulled myself together enough to light a candle and begin to go wretchedly to bed. A few minutes later, there was a knock on the door to the landing and Stephen called out, "I don't want to come in, but please read the note I'm pushing through to you." I called back, "All right," and saw the note coming under the door. As I picked it up, I heard his footsteps going downstairs, and then the noise of the front door shutting. He had written, "Dearest Cassandra, please do not be unhappy. It will come right. It is just that you are so young. I forget that sometimes because you are so clever. I cannot explain because I think it would make you feel worse, and anyway, I do not know how. But there was nothing wrong happened. It was all my fault. If you forgive me for shocking you so, please write yes on a piece of paper and put it under my door. I am going out now and will not come back until your light is out, so you need not be frightened of meeting me. And I will go to work before you are up in the morning. We won't talk about it. Anyway, not for a long time. You say when. Truly, it is all right. With love, from Stephen." XXXXXX. But not until you want them. On a separate sheet he had written, "Perhaps this will help you to understand. Of course, it is only for when we are married." And then he had copied out four lines from Love's Philosophy. "Nothing in the world is single, all things by a law divine, in one another's being mingle. Why not I with thine?" By Percy Bysshe Shelley. Born 1792, died 1822. I guessed he had put Shelley's name and dates so that I wouldn't think he was stealing poetry again. "Oh, Stephen, I know so well why you used to steal it. I long and long to express my love for Simon, and nothing of my own is worthy. I wrote yes and put it under his door. I couldn't bear not to, and of course it was true in a way. I did forgive him. But it let him believe a lie, that I was upset just because he had shocked me. Since then we haven't been alone once. We talk fairly naturally in front of the others, but I never look straight at him. I suppose he just thinks I am shy. Of course, the honest thing would be to tell him it will never be any good, but even if I could bear to hurt him so, I doubt if I could convince him without owning that I care for someone else, because I certainly showed every sign of its being some good while he was making love to me." "Oh, why did you let him?"
"Let him? You encouraged him, my girl."
"But why? Why? When my whole heart was longing for Simon." Perhaps I could understand myself better if I didn't so loathe remembering it. Even now I haven't quite put down everything that happened. I know this. Asking him to go into the wood was a wicked thing. Wicked to him and wicked to myself. Truly, being so sorry for him had something to do with it, but it was mostly sheer wickedness. And it was only due to Stephen that it didn't turn out much wickeder. I have really sinned. I'm going to pause now and sit here on the mound repenting in deepest shame. Oh dear, that was a great mistake. My mind wandered from repenting to thinking it wouldn't have been a sin if Stephen had been Simon. And changing them over has made me realise more and more how I have spoilt the memory of Simon's kiss. Oh, how can I face my wretched future? I shall have to be Rose's bridesmaid, see her living with Simon at Scotney year after year, watch him worshipping her. And how am I going to hide my feelings when I see them together? If only I could go away. But the one thing I live for is to see Simon again. I have just remembered. I once wrote